Now to a couple stories about food and what it says about the people who make and consume it. First, this past week, scientists placed thousands of small packages of grain, mostly wheat and barley, in an underground storage vault on a remote Arctic island. That vault holds a growing collection of seeds from all the different kinds of crops that people around the world grow for food. As NPR's Dan Charles reports, each of those seeds also represents the culture and history of the people who grow it.
That vault is inside a mountain on a group of islands called Svalbard. It's legally part of Norway, but it's way up in the Arctic Ocean, just 600 miles from the North Pole. Carrie Fowler was there in the darkness and wind and cold to see this latest shipment of seeds arrive. He's director of the organization that runs the vault, the Global Crop Diversity Trust.
We got 25,000 samples, about 500 seeds per sample, from really all over the world.
Collections like this are sometimes called gene banks because they're supposed to preserve part of the world's botanical gene pool. In this case, all the varieties of corn or peas or tomatoes that have disappeared from farmers' fields. They disappeared because farmers turned to a handful of varieties that promise bigger harvests and more profits. But Fowler says the old ones may have genetic traits that we will need someday to fight off diseases or cope with a changing climate.
The seeds that we have up here in Svalbard are the last remnants of these varieties. If those seed samples are lost in some way, then it's extinction for that particular variety.
Every seed that arrived this week has its own story. There's barley that came to the U.S. from Poland in 1938, a plant called amaranth collected from a small farm in Ecuador, South America in 1979. Also, the first seeds from Tajikistan, a small mountainous slice of the former Soviet Union, just north of Afghanistan. To find out more about those seeds, I got in touch with Alexei Morganov. He's a Russian, but he lives in Turkey now and works for CIMMYT, an international research center devoted to corn and wheat. I reached him using Skype. When you go to Tajikistan, Morganov says, you see something you cannot find most other places. Farmers still planting and harvesting all the traditional kinds of wheat, the same kinds their ancestors have grown for thousands of years.
People don't want to give up growing them.
They don't want to give up the traditional wheat, Morganov says, because those varieties have the taste and texture they want.
To prepare especially a homemade bread.
Homemade bread from homegrown wheat is the centerpiece of life in Tajikistan, Morganov says. People there get half of their calories from it. And when they leave home, they're likely to take some along.
They always bring this homemade bread to me.
Is that right?
They take a plane from Dushanbe to Istanbul with Turkish Airlines, and they know there is breakfast and drinks and bread. They still take a couple of, flat breads with you just in case.
Morganov says plant breeders like him have changed their tune about the old varieties in recent years. A few decades ago, they'd encourage farmers to replace them with modern, more productive kinds of wheat. Now, he says, he's more likely to work with those older wheat lines, improving them using traditional techniques, but keeping as much as possible. The idea is to preserve them in the fields and not just in gene banks. Dan Charles, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Katherine Harrison's new book, Enchantments, is a fairy tale mashup of history and magical realism set during the last days of Romanov rule in Russia. The main character is Masha, daughter of the man whom neither fiction, film, nor history can ever seem to quite get enough of, Rasputin. Harrison says the famed mystic may not have seemed like a family man, but he did have a wife and three children.
And once I discovered that he had a daughter and that she had escaped the Bolsheviks, gone to Europe and become eventually a successful lion tamer who toured in the United States as the daughter of the mad monk, it just was irresistible. Now I had a way of seeing into that world.
That world is the glittering but doomed court of the last Romanovs, Nicholas and Alexandra, who took in Rasputin's daughters after his murder in 1916. Alexandra's treasured only son, the Tsarevich Alexei, known as Alyosha in the book, suffered terribly from hemophilia, which history says only Rasputin seemed able to relieve. Harrison says it was easy to imagine that Alexandra might have hoped Rasputin's daughter, Masha, would carry her father's healing power.
Masha is taken aback, to say the least. to discover what the Tsarina's hopes are. But once she meets Alyosha and begins speaking with him, they have an affinity, and it's based on the imagination and storytelling, which is one thing she can do for him.
She's kind of a Scheherazade in this world here.
Yes, I think that's a fair description. She can't cure him, but she can provide solace. And as their relationship evolves, it becomes one of her reinterpreting a world that he sees in very stark terms. He is the realist, or not so much the pessimist, because all of what he expects does come true. But she can divert him from that future that we all know by the sort of magic that she does, by telling stories. And they are stories of Russia and stories of his parents, and they're all transformed for him through her eyes.
So when she is the Scheherazade who is surrounding and cocooning him with wonderful, distracting, and healing stories, one of the things she does for this hemophiliac young man is, in her imagination, give him something that he has been denied. And what would you deny the crown prince who can have almost everything? Well, he can't have a bicycle. So she invents one for him, and she calls him handsome Alyosha. He does all the things that the real crown prince can't do. Would you please read this bit for us?
Yes. Handsome Alyosha's bicycle is red, I told Alyosha, but the handlebars are chrome. Does it have mudguards over the tires? It does. Is it a Raleigh or a Triumph? Neither. It has to be an English bicycle. Says who? I don't like American ones as well as I do English. It's not American or English or French or anything else. It's magic. Handsome Alyosha can pedal it on water and above the clouds. He's ridden it through the heavens. Every new moon, there's a race around the largest of Saturn's rings, and handsome Alyosha always wins.
Then she tells him that the gods are racing it, you know. While Masha may not have had the healing power she was invited into the household to have, she certainly had her own power, and you brought that back to life.
Yes, I hope so. She struck me as a powerful person because of her ability to escape the revolution and her incredibly creative solution to making money. I mean, I always understood her as somebody who would not give up.
You say that this really came alive for you when you discovered that Masha Rasputin had become, in fact, a big cat and lion tamer. She actually did. She escapes to Paris,
yes,
and then to the U.S.?
Yes, she actually did, and her career came to a rather sticky end in Peru, Indiana, in 1935, when she was mauled by a bear and nearly bled to death. So there's that sort of strange symmetry. But it's one of those stories in which it's so clear that individual lives and their trials can intersect with history and change things in a way that's remarkable.
Catherine Harrison's new novel is Enchantments. Catherine Harrison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Jackie Lydon.
What does it say about the college co-ed Susan Fluke, who goes before a congressional committee and essentially says that she must be paid to have sex? What does that make her? It makes her a slut, right? Makes her a prostitute.
Conservative commentator Rush Limbaugh caused national outrage this week with several comments he made about Sandra Fluke, a Georgetown law student who testified in favor of mandatory employer health coverage of contraception. The comments caused such a furor that President Obama personally reached out to Fluke yesterday. And just this evening, Limbaugh issued an apology saying, "My choice of words was not the best, and in the attempt to be humorous, I created a national stir. I sincerely apologize apologized to Ms. Fluke for the insulting word choices. I spoke earlier with Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page, who said the controversy has put Republicans in an uncomfortable position.
There's new pressure now, and it trivializes a very serious issue to many folks out there, women's health, as well as the religious freedom issue, etc. It has now become the kind of an issue that the Republican candidates are being asked about, and the John Boehner, Speaker of the House, 75 Democrats have signed a letter calling on him to condemn Limbaugh. And as one commentator said, there's now the new test of political correctness on the Republican side is how hard can you come out against Rush Limbaugh?
Let's turn to the upcoming primary, Super Tuesday. This week we watched the Republican primaries in both Michigan and Arizona. Romney, of course, won both with just a slight edge in Michigan, his home state. Now, Clarence, Romney has a significant lead in the delegate count. Why is he still not seen as the clear front runner?
Because he doesn't have that clear lead as far as the votes are concerned. He's had a difficult time trying to consolidate enough votes out there to clinch the nomination or even to win a majority in the individual states that he has won.
Clarence, we're going to talk about Ohio, of course, tomorrow when we look ahead to Super Tuesday on the show. But the state is so key, it might as well be called Super Ohio Tuesday.
Right.
Why is Ohio so much in the forefront?
Well, first of all, as they say, every Republican map to Washington goes through Ohio. That's one of those states that's a real must win. It's also very similar to Michigan, which we just saw last week. It's a real good debate platform for how do you bring jobs back to the old Rust Belt. And Ohioans are quite upset the way their economy has been going. They have gone back and forth between the Republicans and Democrats in recent elections. And right now, President Obama's auto bailout, as it's called, has helped Northern Ohio because a lot of that, those Detroit industries, their cars, tires, et cetera, come out of Northern Ohio. So to some degree, President Obama is looking better in Ohio than the Republican leaders are.
I want to turn to the White House and foreign policy. President Obama meets with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House on Monday, and he has warned Israelis that they'll only make a bad situation worse if they move preemptively against Iran. He's also taken a hardline stance against Iran, saying the U.S. will use military force if need be to prevent Iran from developing a bomb. He's not bluffing. Clarence, what message is the president trying to send here?
That last one you mentioned, that he's not bluffing, that really moves the football down the field considerably as far as toughening up his stance, moving him closer to what Benjamin Netanyahu would like to see and what many other supporters of Israel would like to see. At the same time, he's trying to be even-handed here. He's putting the pressure on both Iran and on Israel. And this plays into the election campaign this year, too, because he's gotten a lot of pressure from supporters of Israel as to why he hasn't been to Israel, why he hasn't done more.
That's Clarence Page. He's a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
From wheat in a gene bank, we move now to the bread aisle in your local grocery store. A big part of America's story is baked right into the loaves you see on the shelves, or so says our next guest, Aaron Bobrow-Strain.
I'm just an enormous bread geek, I'll admit it.
He's also written a new book all about white bread. Yes, we know what you're probably thinking.
Bleached white.
Fattening. Doesn't taste like anything.
Just kind of fakeish.
Wonder Bread. The bread that my grandfather likes. I love him, but he's terrible taste in bread.
That was Jeff Grosbeck, Corinthia Gerald, Carol Leegard, and Sarah Taylor, shoppers at a Washington, D.C. supermarket on white bread's current reputation. But Aaron Bobrow-Strain, who teaches food politics at Whitman College in Washington State, says,
the invention of sliced bread was really the culmination of a long process in which bread was engineered and designed to look like a streamlined modern wonder, like an edible piece of modern art. And a lot of the impetus behind it comes out of well-meaning social reformers and food reformers who were concerned about the state of America's bread at that point.
Before the 1920s, it was women in the home and immigrants in small corner bakeries who made the majority of America's bread. It was a time when food production was unregulated and there were a lot of foodborne diseases. The era gave rise to something called the Pure Foods Movement and factory-made bread.
There was a good 20-year period at the beginning of the 20th century of moral panic, real fear about the fact that the country's staple bread was being touched by the hands of these presumably diseased and scary new immigrants.
Hmm.
And so choosing a bread from a shining, white, gleaming, sparkling, modern factory was in many ways a choice that people made to try to protect themselves from what was perceived as a threat, a danger. And a lot of this is wrapped up in anxieties about America's changing racial makeup with the arrival of darker-skinned Eastern and Southern European immigrants.
One of your last chapters is titled How White Bread Became White Trash. And you cite the countercultural revolution beginning in the 1960s as really the turning point for white bread status in American culture.
The 1960s counterculture took up white bread as an emblem of everything that was wrong with America. It was plastic, corporate, stale. It wasn't a particularly new idea in that sense. They were reviving ideas that food gurus had been talking about in the United States since the 1840s. But there is this idea that eating whole wheat bread was both healthy and morally virtuous, kind of an edible act of rebellion. But by the 1970s, we see that big industrial bakeries figure out ways to capitalize on this and make money off that rebellious spirit. And so by the 1990s, with what I would call the artisanal bread baking boom, we see bread going from being a manifestation of a kind of a grassroots food activism to being a high-end niche product.
Hmm. So what did you learn? You spent an awful lot of time thinking about white bread in particular and how our perception of it and bread in general has changed over the years. What has stuck with you out of this project?
I think my message, what I learned in the end, is that those of us who want to change the food system, we need to let go of our obsession with individual food choices, right? The idea that what we need to do is to make sure we're eating the right thing and then educate and empower other people to do that as well. A lot of people talk about our food system today as being broken because we're eating the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some...
Including white bread, you would
including
say?
White bread. And there's obviously a lot to be said for that approach, but I'm trying to, with this book, trying to make the conversation to be about a little bit more than just what we eat, but also the architectures of power that underlie our industrial food system and maintain our industrial food system.
Can we also talk about price, too? Because when you're in the supermarket and you're making a decision about what loaf of bread to buy, the artisanal 7-grain bread is going to be a lot more than the package of white bread sitting on the shelf. And if you're strapped for cash, especially these days, maybe you go with the white bread.
That's right. And I think a lot of white bread manufacturers are hoping for that because their business has been hard hit in recent years. And it's sad to say, but as I see our country becoming more and more unequal in many ways, I suspect that the bread market will continue to segment and become unequal and divided in just the same way.
Although I got to say, if you're having a grilled cheese sandwich, you have to have it on white bread. That's just me.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, about a month ago, I made a sandwich that had kind of garlicky braised kale with Manchego cheese, a fried egg, and I did it on grilled Wonder Bread, and it was fabulous.
Sounds delicious. Aaron Bobrow-Strain teaches food politics at Whitman College in Washington State. His new book is called White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. He joined us from our studios in New York. Aaron, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Rachel.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.